Chapter 9. Taking the Happenstance Out of Happiness. As big tech simulates quick hits of hedonistic pleasure, how can we protect the deeper forms of happiness that involve empathy, compassion, and consciousness? Happiness. Good fortune or luck in life or in a particular affair. Success. Prosperity. Happenstance. A chance event. A coincidence. The Oxford English Dictionary. Just what is happiness? Throughout this book, I argue that pursuit of maximum human happiness should be a primary purpose of technological progress. Striving for happiness is an essential component of being human, uniting us all. Just as we all have ethics, though not necessarily religion, the pursuit of happiness is a universal imperative shared by all humans, regardless of culture or belief system. We are all engaged in the constant pursuit of happiness throughout our lives. Our daily decisions are driven by this impulse to create enjoyable or fulfilling experiences, whether indulging in momentary pleasure, delaying gratification in the service of a longer-term benefit, or pursuing higher fulfillment beyond the basic needs of food and shelter. As we face the coming convergence of man and machine, I think it's essential that we don't confuse luck with happiness. Luck is more accidental, while happiness is a question of designing the right framework. I strongly believe we must put the pursuit of happiness and human flourishing at the centre of this man-machine debate. What purpose would technology serve if it does not further human flourishing? And yes, I think it is possible for us to design our future in such a way that we don't just depend on luck, but rather create the best possible circumstances for happiness. More on that later. Trying to define happiness can be a murky proposition. It's an abstract and subjective concept. Wikipedia defines it as follows. Happiness, gladness or joy, is a mental or emotional state of well-being defined by positive or pleasant emotions ranging from contentment to intense joy. Footnote 162. When I started researching what happiness actually is, I repeatedly ran across a distinction between two different types of happiness. The first, hedonic happiness, is a positive mental high point, usually temporary, and often described as pleasure. It may be fleeting, it may be momentary, and it often leads us into habits. For example, some of our hedonic pleasures can lead to addictions such as food, alcohol, and smoking. Social networks, such as Facebook, have often been described as a pleasure trap, a mechanism for hedonistic self-presentation and pleasure facilitation. The second type of happiness is known as eudaimonic happiness, a kind of deeper happiness and contentment. Wikipedia explains eudaimonia, or the anglicized version, eudaimonia, which I will use in this book, as follows. Eudaimonia is a Greek word commonly translated as happiness or welfare. Footnote 163. Human flourishing is another popular meaning for eudaimonia and may serve as a more accurate terminology for the purpose of this book. When I was a student of Lutheran theology in Bonn in the early 1980s, surprised, I was deeply immersed in the teachings of the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. He was referring to eudaimonia when he wrote some 2,300 years ago that happiness is the meaning and the purpose of life, the whole aim and end of human existence. Eudaimonia is, of course, a central concept within Aristotelian philosophy, along with the terms arete, virtue or excellence, and phronesis, practical or ethical wisdom. Eudaimonia, arete, and phronesis, if you'll pardon my Greek, have since become constant objectives in my work, and I think they are the key to understanding which path humanity should take as it is being steamrolled, or should we say, steampunked, by exponential technological change. In other words, we are already lost in a place humanity has never been before. However, there are ancient threads of wisdom, as above, that may yet serve us to escape this technology-centric maze in which we increasingly find ourselves. What makes us happy? If human flourishing simply meant a more pleasurable life, better and more efficient business, more profit and steady growth fueled by technology, then, by all means, let's agree to use machines and algorithms to achieve that. And for a while, as we spiral towards inevitable hyper-efficiency and what will likely be capitalism crushing abundance, that may work just fine. GDP, GNH, or GPI? Honest criteria of happiness? If we define flourish too narrowly, mostly in economic or financial terms, we will end up with outdated definitions such as gross domestic product, GDP, and gross national product, GNP, rather than a more inclusive measure such as gross national happiness, GNH. GNH is a term originally coined in the 1970s in Bhutan, a country which I had a chance to visit right before the completion of this book. It means applying a much wider, more holistic, ecosystemic approach when measuring the state of a nation. Sometimes put in the context of political happiness, GNH is based on traditional Buddhist values rather than the traditional Western values that GDP or GNP usually reference. Indicators such as economic growth, investment output, return on investment, and employment. The four pillars of GNH philosophy reflect this dramatically different underlying philosophy: sustainable development, preservation and promotion of cultural values, conservation of the natural environment, and establishment of good governance, footnote 164. Similarly, when it comes to making future decisions about the relationship between technology and humanity, I find GNH to be a very interesting, parallel approach because it puts happiness squarely in the centre of measuring progress and value. Economic factors should not overshadow happiness-related issues, an obvious criterion, and efficiency should never become more important than humanity, which is one of my 10 key rules at the end of this book. Another way to measure the success of nations is the Genuine Progress Indicator, GPI, which assesses 26 variables related to economic, social, and environmental progress, footnote 165. GPI is valuable because it takes externalities into full account. The consequences are part of the equation, which is very much what I would propose when addressing the unintended consequences of technology. GPI's economic indicators include inequality and the cost of unemployment. Environmental indicators include the cost of pollution, climate change, and non-renewable energy resources, while social indicators include the value of housework, higher education, and volunteer work. What would happen if we applied a combination of GPI and GNH to achieve a more human-centric measurement of progress? This question will be important because if we continue to measure the wrong things, then we will most likely also continue to do the wrong thing. That would be a cardinal mistake in this age of exponential technological progress. First, the resulting errors would have infinitely larger unintended consequences, and second, doing so would once again give way too much power to technology and way too little to humans. If all we measure is the hard data any given action produces, such as how many sales a certain employee has made, then our conclusions would be seriously biased as well. In practice, none of the uniquely human factors are that simple to measure, such as how many relationships with key clients that person may have, and whether he feels compassion with their issues and challenges. The more we pretend our data, and the artificial intelligence, AI, that learns from it, is 100% complete in a truly human way, the more misguided the system's conclusions. We tend to ignore andro-rhythms in favour of algorithms because we like shortcuts and simplifications. Measuring how much more efficient a business or a country could be because of digitisation and automation might paint a very promising economic picture. However, measuring how happy its employees or citizens would be after everything is automated and robotised might present a very different social perspective. Back in 1968, US Senator Robert Kennedy was already flagging GDP as an ill-guided metric which measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile, footnote 166. For me, this highlights a critical point. Algorithms can measure or even simulate everything except for what really matters to humans. Having said that, I don't mean to belittle what algorithms and technology in general can do for us. I just think it's important to put technology in its place, i.e. to engage where it's appropriate and to disengage where it's detrimental. Misdefining what human flourishing means will only empower machines. My concern is that we will only realise belatedly that we have misdefined flourishing for too long. We have accepted hedonic pleasures as good enough because they can often be manufactured, organised, or provided by technology. Social networks offer a great example. We can indeed experience the pleasure of being liked by others, which is, let's face it, a kind of hedonism, a digital pleasure trap. But we are not likely to experience the happiness of a meaningful and personal human contact in Martin Seligman's perma kind of way, a key term that I will outline below, footnote 167. Maybe we will only truly understand the difference at that final point, when every single feature that makes us human has either been replaced or made near impossible by hyper-efficient and compliance-enforcing technology, when we've forgotten or lost the skills to make anything work on our own. I certainly hope not, but faced with these exponential technological challenges, it is clear that we need to start defining flourishing as growing in a healthy way. This means developing a more holistic view of our future, one that looks beyond the merely mechanistic, reductionist, and often hedonistic happiness approaches favoured by so many technologists. The psychologist Martin Seligman states that true happiness isn't solely derived from external, momentary pleasures. He uses the PERMA framework to summarise the key findings from his research on positive psychology, footnote 168. In particular, humans seem happiest when they have pleasure, tasty food, warm baths, engagement, or flow, the absorption within an enjoyed yet challenging activity, relationships. Social ties have turned out to be an extremely reliable indicator of happiness. Meaning, a perceived quest or belonging to something bigger. Accomplishments, having realised tangible goals. Technology may indeed offer significant value in enabling pleasure and accomplishments and possibly contributing to engagement. In contrast, I don't believe technology will be of material help in furthering real relationships or in establishing sense, purpose or meaning. In fact, quite the opposite may be true, as technology can often be quite corrosive to relationships, as when we obsess with our mobile devices at a family dinner. Technology can muddle meaning and purpose, caused by data overload and careless automation, lead to more extreme filter bubbles, feeding us only that content we seemingly like, and facilitate further media manipulation. Sure, technology, as a tool, not as a purpose, is and will be helpful across the board. But once we go further up the exponential scale, the overuse of and dependency upon it might well be equally detrimental. I often wonder what will happen once exponential technologies really kick in. Will our lives become more hedonistic or more eudaimonic? More hit-driven or more deeply meaningful? Will we fall prey to even shallower pleasures where machines govern and mediate our experience? Or will we strive for happiness that is uniquely human? Compassion, a unique trait connected to happiness. An important human factor to consider in this context is compassion. In his 2015 book, An Appeal by the Dalai Lama to the World, Ethics Are More Important Than Religion, the Dalai Lama speaks about the relationship between happiness and compassion. If we want to be happy ourselves, we should practice compassion, and if we want other people to be happy, we should likewise practice compassion. Footnote 169. Compassion, simply put as the sympathetic concern for the sufferings or misfortunes of others, is one of the hardest things to grasp, and certainly one of the hardest to practice. Compassion is much harder than cleverness and intellectual prowess. Can you imagine a computer, an app, a robot, or a software product that has compassion? A machine that feels what you feel, that resonates with your emotions, and that suffers when you suffer. Sure, we can foresee machines that can understand emotions or even read compassion in human faces and body language. We can also imagine machines that would be capable of simulating human emotions, simply by copying or learning from what we do, and therefore appearing to be actually feeling things. However, the key difference is that machines will never have a sense of being. They cannot be compassionate. They can only ever hope to simulate it well. This is surely a critical distinction we should reflect on in greater detail when we consider the technological tsunamis rushing to swallow us. If we further confused a well-executed simulation with actual being, mistaking an algorithmic version of sentience with actual consciousness, we would be in deep trouble. That confusion is also the central flaw of transhumanism. In my view, machines will become extremely good, fast, and cheap at simulating or duplicating human traits, but they will never actually be human. The real challenge for us will be to resist the temptation to accept these simulations as good enough and allow them to replace uniquely human interactions. It would be a foolish and dangerous move to forsake a truly human eudaimonia experience for the ubiquitously available and quick-hit hedonic pleasures provided by machines. In Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, James Barrett writes, "A powerful AI system, tasked with ensuring your safety, might imprison you at home. If you asked for happiness, it might hook you up to a life support and ceaselessly stimulate your brain's pleasure centres. If you don't provide the AI with a very big library of preferred behaviours or an ironclad means for it to deduce what behaviour you prefer, you'll be stuck with whatever it comes up with. And since it's a highly complex system, you may never understand it well enough to make sure you've got it right." Footnote 170. Happiness versus money. Experiences versus possessions. People often point out that happiness based on material belongings or financial standing is actually rather limited in importance. Research has shown that in so-called developed countries, overall happiness does increase when people make more money, but only to a certain point. Different studies suggest that anything beyond $50,000 to $75,000 per year does not really add much extra happiness to people's lives. The correlation between income and well-being slopes off. Footnote 171. Happiness cannot be acquired or purchased, and therefore would be impossible to stuff into an app, a bot, or some other machine. Supporting evidence suggests that experiences have a much longer impact on our overall happiness than possessions. Footnote 172. Experiences are personal, contextual, timely, and embodied. Experiences are based on those unique qualities that make us human, our andro-rhythms. As noted in the Huffington Post blog in April 2015 by Dr. Zhanjin Liu, Director of Product Innovation at Hope Lab, scholars at the University of Virginia, University of British Columbia, and Harvard University released a study in 2011 after examining numerous academic papers in response to an apparent contradiction. When asked to take stock of their lives, people with more money report being a good deal more satisfied. But when asked how happy they are at the moment, people with more money are barely different than those with less. Footnote 173. Human happiness is, or should be, the primary purpose of technology. Technology, derived from the Greek word techne, method, tool, skill, or craft, and logia, knowledge, from the gods, has always been created by humans to improve their well-being, but now it seems likely that soon technology will be used to improve humans themselves. We used to create technology to improve our life conditions in a way that made spontaneous happiness more likely and more prevalent. For example, Skype, Google Talk, and all kinds of messaging apps allow us to connect to pretty much anyone, anytime, anywhere, and all for free. Now, however, due to exponential and combinatorial technological progress, technology increasingly becomes a purpose in and of itself. We find ourselves trying to get more Facebook likes or constantly having to react to notifications and prompts because the system demands attention. What if the tool becomes the meaning, as has already happened with Facebook? What if they are so irresistible and so convenient that we give them their own purposefulness? When will those smartphones and smart screens, smartwatches and virtual reality, VR, glasses become cognitive themselves and go beyond merely being our tools? What if our external brains can connect directly to our own neocortex? Technology has no ethics, and lives in a cloud of nihilism, a space without beliefs. As much as most of us love technology, we now need to face the fact that it does not have, nor will it ever have, nor should it have, any inherent consideration for our values, beliefs, and ethics. It will only consider our values as data feeds, explaining our behaviour. Bots and intelligent digital assistants, IDA, will increasingly vacuum up, read, and analyse tens of millions of data feeds about me and chew on every digital breadcrumb I drop. However, no matter how much GERD data they gather and analyse, software and machines will never truly comprehend my values or ethics, because they cannot be human in the same way that I am. They will always be approximations, simulations, and simplifications. Useful? Yes. Real? No. Let me give you some examples of the ethical challenges posed by technology advances. Many nuclear scientists did not envision the creation of the atomic bomb when they first worked on the underlying scientific and mathematical challenges. Einstein considered himself a pacifist, but still encouraged the US government to build the bomb before Hitler would. As stated earlier, J. Robert Oppenheimer, widely seen as the father of the atomic bomb, lamented his actions after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Footnote 174. Yet the ethics of the military and political complex in which they operated effectively made both of them contributors to weapons of mass destruction. The Internet of Things, IoT, is another great example. It is certain to be of great benefit in collecting, connecting, and combining vast amounts of data from hundreds of billions of web-connected objects. Hence, it could be a potential solution to many global challenges, such as climate change and environmental monitoring. The idea is that once everything is smart and connected, we can make many processes more efficient, cut costs, and achieve big gains in protecting the environment. While these are clever ideas, the current schemes for realising the IoT are almost completely void of attention to human considerations, andro-rhythms, and ethical concerns. It is totally unclear how privacy will be maintained in this global brain in the cloud, how total surveillance will be prevented, and who will be in charge of all this new data. Right now, the focus is very much on the wonders of efficiency and hyperconnectivity, while the unintended consequences and negative externalities don't seem to be anybody's concern. In healthcare, Silicon Valley exponential abundance expert Peter Diamandis, whose work I generally appreciate a lot, talks in positive terms about Human Longevity Inc., his new startup created with genetics pioneer Craig Venter, and how it will enable us to live much longer, possibly forever. Footnote 175. However, he seems to largely ignore most ethical and moral issues that surround the debate around aging, longevity, and death. Who will be able to afford these treatments? Will only the rich live to be 100 plus? What would it mean to end death? Is death really a disease, as Diamandis says, or is it an integral and unchangeable part of being human? Questions abound, but much like the early days of nuclear weapons research, many Silicon Valley technologists seem to be proceeding as fast and as far as they can without a modicum of reflection on what issues their innovations may end up causing. Death is a great tragedy, a profound loss. I don't accept it. I think people are kidding themselves when they say they are comfortable with death. Ray Kurzweil, footnote 176. The key message here is that technology, like money, is neither good nor bad. It merely exists as a means. In the 1950s, Octavio Paz, the great Mexican poet, summarized it well. The nihilism of technology lies not only in the fact that it is the most perfect expression of the will to power, but also in the fact that it lacks meaning. Why? And to what purpose are questions that technology does not ask itself? Footnote 177. I wonder if the nihilism of exponential technologies would be exponential as well. 1,000 times as nihilistic and maybe equally narcissistic. Will we eventually be a species completely devoid of consciousness, mystery, spirituality, and soul, simply because there's no room for these andro-rhythms in this coming machine age. Two things are critical to consider in this context. One, really great technology should always be designed to further human happiness first and foremost, i.e. not simply result in growth and profit, because just striving for exponential growth and profit is very likely to turn us into machines before too long. This new paradigm will represent a dramatic shift for every business and organisation. 2. Technology with potentially catastrophic consequences, such as geoengineering or artificial general intelligence, should be guided and supervised by those who have proven to possess practical wisdom, what the ancient Greeks called phronesis. Stewardship of these technologies should not be placed in the hands of technology developers, corporations, military bureaucrats, venture capitalists, or the world's largest internet platforms. What will all the technological progress amount to if we as a species do not flourish, if we do not achieve something that genuinely lifts all of us onto another plane of happiness? Consequently, when evaluating new technologies or the latest wave of science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, advances, we should always ask whether or not a particular innovation will actually further the collective well-being of most parties involved in realising it. Will cheaper and faster technologies, more convenience, more abundance, easier consumption, superhuman powers, or further economic gains really make us happy? Will better apps, bots, IDAs, powerful augmented reality, AR, and virtual reality, VR, or instant access to a global brain via a new brain-computer interface, BCI, really mean that we, as a species and individually, will truly flourish? Or will it be primarily those who create, own, and offer the tools and platforms that will reap the rewards? Human well-being should be the goal. Particularly when discussing the future of technology, I feel that well-being, the state of being comfortable, healthy, or happy, is becoming the key word. Well-being implies a more holistic approach that goes way beyond measuring our body functions, our mental computing power, or the number of synapses in our brains. It expresses embodiment, context, timeliness, connectedness, emotions, spirituality, and a thousand other things that we have yet to explain or even understand. Well-being isn't algorithmic, it's andro-rhythmic, based on complex things such as trust, compassion, emotion, and intuition. Technology is often very good at creating great so-called well moments, such as being able to call a loved one anywhere and anytime I want. However, well-being is something that transcends technological facilitation to a very large degree. Having immersed myself in internet entrepreneurship and dabbled with digital music startups for almost 10 years, it was only after the sudden demise of my dot-com enterprise back in 2002 that I learned how a more holistic well-being really comes from relationships, from meaning, from purpose, and from context. Happiness cannot be automated. Can technology manufacture happiness? Exponential technologies, such as AI, will undoubtedly attempt to create the conditions in which human happiness, or even well-being, can be furthered. Some will also actively seek to manufacture it for us, or at least a digital approximation of it. Increasingly, we are seeing arguments that happiness can be programmed or otherwise organized or orchestrated by super smart technology. The key argument of the techno-progressive thinkers is that being happy is just the result of the right kinds of neurons firing at the right time, in the right order. They reason that it's all just biology, chemistry, and physics, and can thus be understood, learned, and copied completely by computers. We are looking at a society increasingly dependent on machines, yet decreasingly capable of making or even using them effectively. Douglas Rushkoff, Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commandments for a Digital Age, footnote 178. Maybe we can create a kind of happiness machine that would manipulate, control, and program us and our environment. Maybe there is an app for that, or at least there should be. Take a look at www.happify.com to see how the idea of organising happiness is already being marketed, a software tool that teaches you happiness. One can only imagine how this could turn out by 2025. An app that connects directly to your brain via a BCI or via tiny implants to make sure we are happy all the time and, critically, that we consume happiness all the time. It sometimes seems to me that the entrepreneurs pursuing these exploits think that human emotions, values and beliefs should be subject to even more exponential advances in STEM. The rationale seems to be that once we get far enough down this path, all of it will be subject to programming by us, including, you guessed it, ourselves. Then we can finally rid ourselves of our biological constraints and become truly universal beings. I can't wait. Moodbots and tech pleasures. Technology is already able to create, program, or manipulate pleasurable moments, i.e. hedonic happiness, for us. And this is a business that will certainly boom in the near future. This already happens on the Facebook newsfeed, which displays only those items that will make you feel good and liked. It's happening in e-commerce with shopping sites that employ hordes of neuroscientists to fine-tune new digital instant satisfaction mechanisms. It's being done in healthcare with nootropics, so-called smart drugs and cognitive enhancers, that are supposed to give you a kick of super mental capabilities. And soon, it will be done via very skillful manipulation of our senses through the voice and gesture-controlled, not typed, conversations that we'll have with our omnipresent digital assistants. It will also take place via AR and VR devices, such as Facebook's Oculus Rift, and new kinds of human-computer interfaces and neural implants. Computers will try to make us feel happy. They will try to be our friends, and they'll want us to love them. And it will only get worse, or better, depending on your viewpoint. A September 2015 article by Adam Pyor in the Nautilus Journal highlights how these mood bots might function. James J. Hughes, a sociologist, author, and futurist at Hartford's Trinity College, envisions a day not too far from now when we will unravel the genetic determinants of key neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, and oxytocin, and be able to manipulate happiness genes, if not serotonin-related 5-HTT-LPR, then something like it, with precise nanoscale technologies that marry robotics and traditional pharmacology. These mood bots, once ingested, will travel directly to specific areas of the brain, flip on genes and manually turn up or down our happiness set point, colouring the way we experience circumstances around us. As nanotechnology becomes more precise, we're going to be able to affect mood in increasingly precise ways in ordinary people, says Hughes, who also serves as executive director of the Institute of Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and authored the 2004 book Citizen Cyborg: Why Democratic Societies Must Respond to the Redesigned Human of the Future, footnote 179. I would argue that digital technology has already become pretty good at furnishing hedonic pleasures to its users. Just think about apps, personal digital assistants, and social media in general, where the entire purpose of connecting with others is often reduced to getting a quick dopamine boost based on the responses of complete strangers. In a way, social networks are already pretty amazing hedonistic happiness generators. But of course, the key question is, what could exponential technological gains possibly do to furnish or even support eudaimonia, happiness as the meaning and the purpose of life, as the aim of human existence? Or support our striving towards a noble purpose, or discovering the meaning of life? This strikes me as mission impossible, simply because technology does not ask about or concern itself with purpose at all, and why should it? Then there is the question of whether such eudaimonian happiness can be planned, orchestrated, or prearranged at all, digital or not. This is a concept which Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychologist and founder of logotherapy, explores in his 1946 book, Man's Search for Meaning. Happiness cannot be pursued. it must ensue, and it only does so as the unintended side effect of one's personal dedication to a cause greater than oneself, or as the byproduct of one's surrender to a person other than oneself. The more a man tries to demonstrate his sexual potency, or a woman her ability to experience orgasm, the less they are able to succeed. Pleasure is, and must remain, a side effect or byproduct, and is destroyed and spoiled to the degree to which it is made a goal in itself. Footnote 180. The idea that hedonic pleasures are a side product of a larger flourishing, eudaimonia, makes a lot of sense to me. Hence my argument that we should embrace technology, experience the pleasure of it, but not become technology, as this would make the experience of a real eudaimonia impossible. Be careful what you wish for. The debate over whether we should extend human longevity dramatically and pursue the end of dying is a great example of the difficulty of determining whether a particular technological advance will result in human flourishing. It also points to one of the biggest dilemmas we may be facing soon. If something can be done, does it mean it should be done? Should we consider not doing things because they might also have negative side effects on human flourishing? Breakthrough gene editing technologies such as CRISPR-Cas9 may eventually help to end cancer or Alzheimer's and would clearly contribute to our collective well-being. However, another application of this scientific magic may also bring about programmable babies, dramatically increased longevity, or even the end of dying for humanity, but likely only for those few who have the significant resources that would no doubt be required. How will we make sure the advances will be 95% positive for humanity and not cause social disruption, terrorism, or exponential inequality? In Silicon Valley, the epicenter of human technology convergence, Peter Diamandis likes to say, "The question is, what would people be willing to spend for an extra 20, 30, 40 years of a healthy life? It's a huge opportunity." Footnote 181. That comment speaks volumes about the Silicon Valley philosophy. Everything is a business opportunity, even human happiness. Consider the rise of what science writer Amy Maxman, writing in Wired magazine in July 2015, called the Genesis Engine, i.e. the concept of editing human DNA, footnote 182. The first step will be the analysis of the DNA of billions of people to identify which genes are responsible for different conditions and diseases. Brute computing power and broad public support for the concept will be required. Second, once a gene has been identified as being responsible for something as detrimental as cancer, assuming it will be that straightforward, the next step will be finding ways to remove or suppress that gene so that the disease does not develop. Third would be the idea of essentially programming people like we program software or apps today, removing all the bad bugs and adding in great features. Does that strike you as a desirable future? Most people would answer with a resounding yes, because it sounds too good to be true. Yet the mind boggles when we think about what realizing such scientific feats could mean in a broader context. Who could afford such treatments? Who would regulate where they could or could not be applied? Would we open all doors to superhumans and close the door to plain old humans? Would the possibility of programming our genes mean we would inadvertently be on our way to becoming more like machines? On the one hand, editing the human genome for the purpose of ending diseases would definitely result in increased well-being and happiness. But the very same capabilities could easily result in civil wars or terrorism. Just imagine if only the super rich could avoid all life-threatening diseases and live to be 150 years old, while everyone else would wither at 90 years old or younger, or not even be able to afford basic health care. If there were ever grounds for resorting to civil unrest out of sheer desperation, look no further. How could we even conceive of offering such possibilities without first considering these vexing ethical and societal issues? Why would we spend trillions of euros on STEM, but invest so very little in what I call the core humanity issues? Creativity and compassion, originality, reciprocity and responsibility, and empathy. a positive example. We don't have to look to such extreme examples to find a compelling argument for or against a digitally mediated human experience. Consider Wikipedia, a non-profit global knowledge base, a positive example of a boost to collective well-being delivered through technology. The creation of Wikipedia, to a very large extent, fueled the betterment of society. At a time when knowledge and information were not readily accessible to all, Wikipedia opened up access to everyone everywhere, without the costs of paying for old-fashioned dictionaries, libraries, or commercial and government databases. Admittedly, people around the globe are happy about having Wikipedia, and its co-founder, Jimmy Wales, is widely revered as having furthered the collective progress of society with this innovation. In addition, the unintended consequences of Wikipedia, such as the demise of the printed version of Encyclopaedia Britannica, could be viewed as somewhat negligible. Wikipedia, therefore, makes a good case of technology furthering well-being and human flourishing, but it's certainly not flawless. As a case in point, this author's English language listing was deleted in 2011 for lack of notability. In contrast, innovations such as Tinder, a popular dating and messaging app, just in case you have not yet had the pleasure, Google Maps, or the Apple Watch, don't really further collective well-being in the same way as Wikipedia did. Even though they are all quite possibly useful and even endearing, they are simply commercial expressions of a yes-we-can approach to lifestyle technology. Useful? Yes. Furthering general well-being? Probably not. Or at least, not to the same degree as Wikipedia. Trading happiness for tech-powered hedonism? Imagine if we could easily simulate the feeling of intimacy with a human sexual partner by using a good-looking, sophisticated, AI-powered sex robot. Yes, this is a rapidly growing industry, in case you were wondering. Footnote 183. By all means, having sex with robots qualifies as a decidedly hedonistic experience. One wonders, would we still be as interested in pursuing true happiness and a complete sexual experience in an actual, real-life, human-to-human relationship where we actually need to struggle to make it work? Or would we get used to the ease with which sex robots would be available, and therefore just settle for convenience? How tempting would it be to resort to such a consumerist attitude to sex? And conversely, who are we to deny people the right to enjoy whatever they want? Sure, you may argue that we would still know the difference, and we certainly would. But how much would we be altered, in our minds, by making constant use of sex robots? Would it not mess with our brains and distort our perception of reality, our views of what the real world is actually like? Studies of men who routinely watch pornography have shown that extensive use has significant impact on the stimulation required for arousal and for what's required to reach orgasm. Footnote 184. Just imagine how that issue would be magnified by sex robots, which are dead certain to become very smart, cheap, and incredibly human-like. Just watch a few episodes of AMC's Humans to see where this could be going. Footnote 185. Does that mean we should ban sex robots because they lead us to inhuman practices? I would propose there would be no harm in banning the next generation of human-like robots, socially and otherwise. But of course, that is unlikely to stop their availability. This is but one example of how exponential technological gains, in this case artificial skin, robotics and AI, could lead us down the path of hedonistic happiness at an ever faster pace, at lower cost and with widespread availability. So the key question is, will exponential technologies further our well-being? And if so, who would be in charge of making sure that they don't flip inadvertently or by design? Who decides what is human and what is not? And at what point are we crossing a line that distinguishes us from the tools we have created? This is the inherent tension between man and machine that technology cannot possibly resolve. Even if the entire human brain and its 100 billion neurons could eventually be simulated. Compassion and happiness, like consciousness, simply do not exist in mere biological or chemical terms, but in the holistic interplay of everything that is human. Machines or software are unlikely to ever attain these states. even if they quickly become better at simulating them to some extent. Clearly, computer programs can already measure or detect compassion using facial recognition techniques, and software could probably simulate compassion after having reviewed trillions of variations of facial expressions and linguistic indicators. Attempts at first defining and then programming a human characteristic such as compassion or something as mysterious as consciousness seem like a far-fetched and unrealizable concept in the foreseeable future. But then again, is the real danger that a great simulation will quite possibly be good enough for most of us? I'm increasingly worried about the idea that we may sooner or later be okay with having something close enough. Putting technology back in its place. I fundamentally believe that computers, software programs, algorithms, and robots are unlikely to ever develop human-like compassion or empathy. Robots and AI as helpers and servants, yes, but certainly never as masters. Should we really try and utilize mathematical models or machine intelligence to optimize emotional outcomes? And in the context of machine thinking, should we really attempt to deploy better technology to solve social or political problems, such as using overbearing surveillance techniques to end terrorism? The complex andro-rhythmic values must remain the domain of human beings, both because we are better at creating nuanced expressions of them and because direct engagement with those problems is key to developing eudaimonia, deeper happiness. I often wonder whether exponential technological progress will generate exponential human happiness beyond the 1% of those who will create, own, and profit from such brilliant miracle machines. Is it a virtuous goal to construct a perfect human machine that can be freed of all its flaws and inefficiencies so that we can finally become God, whatever that might mean? I don't know about you, but that isn't a world I would strive to build. Suppose we pursue this path is like gambling with our future and potentially poisoning the well for our children and the generations to come. Happiness cannot be programmed into machines, automated or sold. It cannot be copied, codified or deep learned. It needs to emanate from and grow within us and in between us, and technology is here to help us as a tool. We are a species that uses technology, not a species that is destined to become technology. Finally, think about this. The word happiness itself stems from the Viking word for luck, hap. This also relates to the concept of happenstance or chance. The apologists for technology may profess that they are removing the negative elements of chance from human lives, which we all know are legion, from disease and poverty to death itself. However, in doing so, they may be systematically altering the ability of human beings to experience deeper levels of happiness that are not dependent on measurable circumstance. Yes, by all means, let us use the tools of technology to remove the dangerous risks of being human on planet Earth. But no, let's not become the tools of our tools and surrender our mercurial consciousness and sovereign free will for a bunch of trinkets and cheap thrills like the innocent natives of some new world.